I didn't like. The more I thought about it, the more I didn't really like the way the classroom was set up. Still, more and more like it was a good discussion. You guys were always participating, but it felt a little bit like teacher students, like a lecture kind of situation. And you know, whenever you're teaching, and we make this point from a leadership standpoint, if you're in the class on learning how to be a teacher, you're the leader. You know, you're supposed to set the tone for the class and figure out the way the class is supposed to go. So there's a place for that. And all. But if you're teaching a book, you know, you're supposed to have done a little more work than everybody else. But generally speaking, the things that come up in the book are not necessarily things that fit you or not. They're just the things that come along. I began to feel a little more uncomfortable to be talking about being an elder, being a leader, and things like that. And then standing up while you sat down, I just thought, this is crazy. You know, I don't know how to get across the way that Marty and Larry and Sewell and all participate in this class, the way that we feel about these kinds of discussions. We're doing the best we can, or have done the best we can in terms of serving in this role, but there is a recognition that you're never really where you want to be. So if, looking back over the class, if we left the wrong impression in any place about feeling like, you know, somehow we're talking about a standard and we're there, and like to drag everybody else up to that, that's not the intention at all. And it felt particularly uncomfortable afterwards kind of thinking about that, the idea of leadership on Wednesday night, which the more I've studied this material and thought about it and done these classes, and the more I've served as an elder, the more important the aspect of leadership seems to me to be. And yet, you know, to be the one standing up and talking about that just seemed kind of out of place. So, that said, hopefully this will help a little bit. The other thing I've enjoyed about these classes, both here and when we've done them elsewhere, is it's given me an opportunity to kind of reflect back on a lot of blessings, a lot of opportunities to do things over the years. What it's also forced me to do is to also think about the ways in which I have needed to be a leader, needed to be doing things that were in service to God, and wish I had done it more like what I'm now able to teach about. And if you think these things through enough, and listen to people who give you great ideas as we're discussing these things, you think, well, that's really good. I need to present that. But those are not really things that I necessarily did in my own family. We'll talk about that a little bit this morning. I think of all of you as leaders. You know, I thought Doug would be here this morning. I'll even point out, you know, Doug's not married, never has been. But Doug, I think, is a leader in terms of service, which is one of the areas we're going to talk about. All of you are married. All of you have children. So this first part we're going to talk about, you are in the midst of being a leader in some fashion. I want you to think about it in terms of how it kind of prepares you to be an elder. But let's start. Everybody got lesson six? I want to start with these passages about aspiring to be an elder, preparing. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 1. And you can look it up in your Bible. I gave five different translations here for you to take a look at. And in these five, if you look at every one of these verses, or every rendition of the verse, you can see that there are three clauses that are in this one verse. Right? What's the first clause? You pick any of the translations. Just what's the first clause?
A trustworthy statement.
Okay. It is a trustworthy statement. I mean, here's a noun, a verb. It is a trustworthy statement. And in those translations, that word trustworthy, there's one other way that it's rendered.
Faithful.
What seems to me that he's about to say here is, I'm going to tell you something you can count on. this is an absolute, unquestionable, undebatable statement. You can count on this. And then there's two other clauses. It's the middle one seems to me to be pretty much a clause. What's the second one? If any man aspires...
To the office of an overseer.
You know, that's kind of the full statement. If any man aspires to... I think the if here is more like when. It's describing a situation. If this happens, then this. You know, it's not doubting. It's not kind of posing, okay, well, I'm going to talk about situations where he does and situations where he doesn't. It's really kind of like, when this happens, something else comes along with it. And what is that? What's that third clause?
It is
a fine work. It's a good work. But actually, it doesn't just say that it is a good work. What does it say about it?
That's what he wants. He desires it.
He desires a good work, a noble task. A number of ways that it kind of speaks to what it is that he's desiring. This kind of broad, right? Fine work, good work, and a noble task. Those are the three ways it's rendered among these five passages. The most interesting thing when I kind of dug a little deeper last night in this is, look at the last one, the New King James Version, which might be the one that we heard the most. You notice here in the second and the third clause, the verb is the same in English, right? It's desires, both cases. It's not the same word in the Greek, which surprised me. And I guess you kind of might have guessed that if you looked at the other four, where one says aspires, desires, sets his heart on desires, aspires, desires, seeks, desires. The last one always kind of comes across as desire, but the other earlier one is a little bit different. And this is the way, I didn't do a lot of research on this. It'd be nice to have some more time and go back. But that first one, the way Thayer describes it is that it's to stretch oneself out in order to touch. It's a word like you're stretching out to try to touch or to reach out for something. And the way, this is the idiom we would use, I don't know if it's completely appropriate, it kind of sounds like it, thinking of that, is this idea of aspiring to this office is like stretching yourself. You know, you're going to push yourself to reach out to try to get some of this, but it's a little beyond your effort. You know, it's going to take some effort on your part, right? That's what you're doing. You're making this effort to try to get there. And then the second of those words is a little bit closer to what we think of it. I think it's why it says desire in all of those cases. It's more like, it's to long for was one of the definitions. But I like this. It actually means... The way they used this phrase in Greek was to keep the heart turned upon a thing. We don't go around talking about my heart's turned upon a thing, but we do say that our heart is set on something, which I thought was interesting because that's actually one of the translations for the first word back in the NIV. The NIV is a little bit looser on those things. But it's this idea of real, I'd like to have this. Now, what is the danger when we think about desiring this office? What's the danger that we sometimes want to bring in?
Just want the position and the notoriety and the fame, so to speak.
It's a little bit of that kind of selfish kind of ambition, the recognition for it, exactly. But if you look at a passage carefully, if a person's really doing what this passage is talking about, it seems to me it'd be difficult to have that kind of desire. Right? Because in the first place, what you're doing is you're making this effort to try to be able to do something, to kind of reach out to be able to touch it. But when it brings in then the more intense word about wanting something, desiring it, it immediately attaches it to what? What is it you're desiring?
The task, the work.
Yeah.
The work.
Which is described as being a good work, finally, a noble work. Not at all something that's meant to be selfish. So I think all of that's kind of helpful to look at that and to keep someone from ever feeling like, okay, if I desire this, well, that sounds like I've got some kind of ambition. No, what it's saying is it put yourself in a position where you're kind of like stretching out to try to be able to do this. And if you do, what you're desiring is a really good thing. It's a noble task. It's a work that you're trying to do. So I'll ask this question. I can give a literal answer to it, but is it possible to develop into an elder? We won't define how good, but to develop into an elder without ever really having made a specific plan toward that? No idea about, well, here's how I'm going to stretch out, or is it possible to become an elder without having done that?
I think so. Caller talked about and taking someone unawares, just trying to be a Christian he should be and serving him.
I don't remember making much plans. I wish I had. You know, it's kind of going back to this class. It's ironic. It's almost shameful to kind of stand in front of as many men as I have and say, you ought to make a plan and figure this out. Think ahead. You know, and now, I do think that there is a sense in which if you'll put your head down and work hard at being what Christ wants you to be, that you can develop well into what an elder ought to be. But we need to enrich that idea of putting your head down and working hard. And that's part of what this lesson's all about. What are the things that a man ought to be doing over the course of his life that would more naturally prepare him to be an elder? And yet, there are some aspects to this. So that's kind of the second question. Do you think it's more likely that he might be ready and then become an elder if he actually made this some kind of a goal? You know, something where he said, okay, well, I'm going to stretch out.
Absolutely. Typically, that's always the case when you set a goal.
Most other things, right? So you would think that in some way, and again, we want to be cautious about that selfish kind of ambition, but if it's this kind of aspiration that's described here, it's good. And you would just think it would be helpful in terms of preparing a man to do it. So I think that if you had this kind of desire, this fourth question, would it be reflected in efforts of preparation? Well, I've had this question on this lesson sheet now for a number of years and talked to several places, and just last night it kind of occurred to me, if you really define, you go back and look at the definitions of the word correctly, there's no way that it wouldn't be. I mean, the whole idea of stretching out is, to me, it seems an idea of preparation. Making some effort along the way. It's not just in my heart, I wish I could be. It's a little bit of this aspiring and effort that's involved in it. So I'm going to talk this morning about some of that effort. I want y'all to help in this. So here's back to our discussion on Wednesday night. I think elders have to be leaders. You've got to have some initiative. You've got to have some vision. Ultimately, what are elders trying to accomplish? Let's go back to some of our earlier lessons. Just about what's the goal that elders should constantly have in mind?
Helping those in the flock get to heaven.
Go on.
No, same thing.
And bring them more along.
Bring them farther along. Other ways of describing it?
Protecting.
Okay. So, you know, things may be going relatively well, but there are other forces kind of trying to harm them, which would upset these goals, as been said.
Which kind of troubles me now. The more I think about it, how many 20 and 30 year old men are actually aspiring?
Right. I don't know.
Or is it you get to a point in your life where you start thinking a different way about that?
You know, that's an interesting question, because every once in a while I'll be somewhere where somebody will talk to a group of teenage boys about how important it is for them to set now this vision of being an elder. And there's a good point in that, and then there's a piece of it that I think, you know, it's so far down the line, you'd be better off to focus on some other things in between now and then. But someone will say, you know, if you don't marry the right on your wife, you may know, well, that's good, that's true, but you don't marry the right kind of woman, then it may upset your soul for your entire, you know, there are all kinds of other, that if you would do things in the right way, you'd be headed down that path. So I guess one way of answering it, Sam, might be, the idea ought to always be there, but it begins to germinate and grow and get bigger as you get closer.
Yeah. Well, I've said this before. I remember the idea being placed there when I was in high school.
Oh, that's right. You did.
And I can always remember him having said that, but I remember at the time what a fantastical concept it was. Mm-hmm. Like, how is that even possible? And I think it was probably after I had seen my children get to a certain age before I even had any thoughts about that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's some of the preparation that we need before we get serious.
I think, and that's, I'm not at all dismissing the idea you could plant this idea earlier and it can be a good thing, it can kind of, but really you need to be leaders now where you can be, and it will prepare you in that sense. I think you're right. I think
it's just me, but it wasn't really a thought that I had.
Now, as you get closer and closer, I'll kind of jump ahead to some of the, there's three areas of service. I think I'm going to try to add a fourth as we talk about this, in which we are preparing ourselves. There begin to be some things that, if you don't have that notion in your mind at all, you're not going to be as ready as you need to be, as prepared. And I think especially it has to do with the things that you study, think through, issues that are worthy of it, some other tasks that you may take on along the way that would be good for you to be involved and engaged in, things about what kind of work life you have, decisions that you might make. Those kinds of things begin to be more and more important. But, and I don't know if y'all agree or disagree with Sam. I tend to agree more with that. I'm not exactly sure what it means to a 20 or 21-year-old young man to say, you've got to start making your goal right now to be an elder. Not a bad thing. Just, it's not as tangible as it may seem to be.
It seems, working with young people, they it's difficult for them to think long term. I mean, everyone needs to prepare for their death. Everyone needs to prepare for their retirement. Everyone needs to prepare for things that are long term. But people who are young have this notion that I'm young forever, and so
it's not true.
It's not.
And when does that? I was gonna say, when does that notion stop?
Yeah. In some ways, it never stops.
You know, we have been in body, right? So it's not like it's impossible.
Well, and Andrew Goins is in here too, and I like having younger men in these classes because, again, I think it sparks an idea that has value over a long period of time. Well,
especially just one more comment. What Bill's going with is the foresight of where you want to be 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. Decisions that, it's important for them to know, I think, at a younger age, decisions they make now can affect that where they are 20, 15 years from now. And to kind of plant that seed is kind of helpful for them as well.
Got to be careful, though, in encouraging not to look at it like their career path. I mean, when they're visualizing what they want to do and where they want to be and they're working backwards and the income level they want to have and all that, that's not the kind of thinking that goes into this. This is more about where do I want to be as a Christian?
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm someone who wants to serve, what do I need to do to get there rather than I want to hit that office at the same time I hit VP?
Yeah, right. No, but there are aspects of your work life that could affect whether you could be as effective in this, and you can be thinking about those. And again, those are a little bit difficult to do when you can't even figure out what your degree is going to be in, your first job is going to be. You start thinking, and that's why I tend to think more as you've described, Sam. But I want to look at two qualifications, first of all, out of 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1. These are qualifications for an elder related to the family. And then I want you to think about the fact that all of you are husbands, fathers, and how that you are engaged now in some of the very things that it relates in terms of being qualified. 1 Timothy 3, 4, and 5, he must manage his own household well with all dignity. keeping his children submissive, for if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? There's a sense in which the work and effort you're making in caring for your family ought to be reflected in your readiness to serve as an elder. And then Titus 1:6, if anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife and his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination. Here it's a little more of the product side of it, but his children are believers, and their conduct is such there's not this kind of rebellious, wayward type conduct that you can see there. What I really wanted you to do, though, is to think about these four passages that are under question one. Without going into the first three, I do want to go back to Ephesians in just a second. Without going to the first three, what do you remember as you read through those that suggests that a husband is a leader? Because you are. What tells you that?
In there, the word manage?
Yeah. Well, the word manage was in that part about the qualification, but in these, head is in there. The husband is the head of the wife. It's what 1 Corinthians 11 talks about.
And the wife is to be in subjection or submission to the husband.
Yeah, which kind of turns it around a little bit. It's from her perspective, but if there's an element of subjection or submission, then there's the idea of really a following. It's what's in it. And if somebody's going to follow you, then you're expected to be a leader. It's implicit in that passage. But I want you to look at Ephesians 5. And this is one of the things that recently has helped me a lot. Always too late. Or maybe later than I wish.
Verse 45.
Yes, let's go. I want you to look in Ephesians 5. The same kind of ideas come up, you know, verse 22, wives are to submit to their husbands. Husbands ahead of the wife. You get kind of both of those concepts in this one passage, 22 and 23. But I want you to look for the goal. What is his headship, his leadership all about? What's he trying to accomplish? To sanctify. I mean, look, just take these words carefully. First of all, the example, of course, is you're a head, a leader, as Christ is for the church. We'll come back to think about that in a minute. But husbands, in verse 25, love your wives as Christ loved the church, gave himself up for it. That, this is the goal starting verse 26. He might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. So here's the whole goal, it seems to me, that's involved in a husband being the leader in the family with his wife. When I was young, I don't know if anybody explained this to me, but it's probably because I just don't listen carefully. Somebody probably did. I remember kind of thinking about, okay, I'm supposed to be the head. What exactly does that mean? So you kind of look for those places, almost kind of ready. I'm ready for that moment when we don't agree on something, right? We're trying to make a big decision. We don't quite have the same viewpoint. And at least I get the idea of headship there, right? If we don't agree on which way are we going to go?
You're the husband, your way.
I'm mom, right? I get the tiebreaker here. I get to figure out that. Tie being 1-1, and I break into my favor, right? And, you know, over time, I do remember understanding more and more that it was about for her benefit. I got to put her interests first. You can't be selfish in these things, and those are all helpful. I did not spend nearly the kind of thought about, okay, but what ultimately is the goal? When you say that you're going to do what's in her best interest, does that necessarily mean what she would prefer versus what you would prefer? Because there are times when it's a completely unimportant kind of matter. She would like to have it one way, you'd like to have it another. Which way really should you be leaning?
You better be
leaning. Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in that statement. You should be, you know, because that's the lack of selfishness in all. It's not really just talking about Colonel, like, you know, when it doesn't really matter, lean for her way or do things that make her happy or search for her happiness. Ultimately, what's your goal for her? What is it? To help her go to heaven. But and you know, sometimes we jump all the way to that kind of finish line of going to heaven, but in order for her to really be that person, what's going to happen along the course of her life? What do we all need?
Encouragement.
We need encouragement. We need to change. We need to grow. You know, don't go talk to her about this. Don't remind her of this. But just think about your wife when you married her. At that age, young. Think about her immaturity. Think about the things that she struggled with to be the right kind of person to others. Think about how, you know, she was probably a little more selfish, self-centered. You know, if she has changed and become more and more the new man and more of what Christ wants her to be, would she be the same now after 10, 15, 20, 30 plus years of marriage that she was at the beginning? You'd like to think not. If you've done your part, you've helped to cleanse her, to sanctify her, to make her more and more what Christ wants her to be. And that's the leadership that the passage is really talking about or wanting out of Hedges. And I'll just be frank, I don't remember thinking with that kind of vision, you know, in our relationship. I remember kind of learning more and more, I'm not supposed to be getting my way. I got to, you know, stop arguing the way that I do, and I got to stop, you know. And I've changed and gotten to be a better person, but I don't remember having that vision. That was it. Because that vision sounds just like what that we talked about earlier.
Teenagers looking forward to being.
Yeah, but the goal of an elder being kind of the way Bill described it, right? We're trying to help individuals. It's the same work. It's just that you start with one person. The one that you'll know the best, you'll be the closest, you'll have the most influence over, but you should be starting and thinking about the work you're doing with your wife. And look, whether you figured that out or not, if you're a good, godly man, you've been doing some of that whether you really thought it through or not. You've been trying to help her. But it just... It's given me a better picture of what marriage is all about because we've been having the elder classes. I taught a marriage class recently. I thought, I got a better vision to describe y'all about marriage because I think I've learned it from being an elder and thinking through this class, which is ridiculous. It'll be the other way around, right?
So that's got a training program.
He's got it. That's exactly what it is. There is a training program, too. And so I want to ask y'all a couple of questions about this kind of a training program. I'd like to know let's answer question C and E together. You're here too early. Is it C and E in your version of this? So here's a question you can think these things through. How can a wife aid a man in his preparation to be an elder? And what skills or understanding is a man likely to gain from his relationship with his wife that he will need in being a shepherd? That last one maybe is a little bit more of what he's going to learn as he tries to, you know, implement this goal of sanctifying her. But then there's the influence that your wife has had on you. And I'd like to kind of hear a little bit how you think that it helps a man. Why do you need a wife? That was one of the qualifications. That you already would have. I'll give you some things in a minute we'll think about after you're an elder once.
You've got to be able to check that box.
You've got to be able to check the box. That's the number one reason why you need to have a wife. That's the number one reason why she'll help you is you can then, as you aspire to that office.
All the way back to Genesis. Help me.
Help me.
Right.
That's the key touched on it earlier. It's to learn not to be self.
Learn how to deal, and it's supposed to be the weaker vessel. So a lot of what we talked about earlier is weak members.
Patience.
Dealing with patience with ones that are weak.
Yeah, it's good. You know, 1 Peter 3, verse 7, having given like 6 verses of devotion to the wife, takes one to the man. What does it tell the husband to do? He should
dwell with understanding.
Dwell with understanding. And there's a lot that you aren't. Half of those that you will be responsible for as an elder are women. And here is another training ground of kind of understanding a lot of differences between a man and a woman, the way that she thinks that that's helpful. Patience, you said, is part of what you ought to have learned out of that.
Well, you described earlier, leadership is not making decisions, it's about sacrifice.
Yes.
And how do I lead is by putting other people's interests first.
And so if I've approached this correctly, I've also learned the right kind of model of leadership, the servant kind of leadership that's described, which I should have exercised with my wife. But
decision making isn't, this is because I said so.
Yes.
It's getting there together.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point, Danny, because even if we do it truly for her best interest, I mean, there's no question this is going to help. Has it ever really come across well to just say, not to explain it, not to, you know, it's just this is the way we're going to do it, period. Is that ever really the best?
Only
with
kids.
Only with kids. I'll just talk about kids in a minute. There's a little bit of a different kind of model of leadership there because you cannot force your wife to do things. And so there's also that part of that kind of leadership where you're doing it out of your influence. And if you're not a godly person, if she sees all this love, then it makes it that much more difficult to be, not that you can't leave, but it makes it, it's a handicap, right? But you're right, when your children are slightly different, but the older they get, the less you can do that.
Well, I think the model is valid. If you think about young Christians and erring Christians, we ought to be very firm in exhorting and necessary rebuking. That's a lot like the discipline that you have to exercise with a child.
Yes.
You don't reason with a child.
That's right. And we're going to come to that in a minute. That's kind of the second part of family. But just one other thing that I want you to think really about. What can a wife do for you that's unique? In the role, in the place that she has in your life that's just different than what others may be able to do. Should be able to. Not, this is a picture of a good relationship I'm trying to paint. What can she do for you?
There's a feature.
Who knows you better? And it's really part of the ideal marriage. This is the way God has meant for it to be, is that you have two people who are so committed to staying together, no matter what, that they're able then to expose to one another their flaws and their, you know, their mistakes and all that. And I don't mean really through confession so much as I mean just you can't hide it. You know, I mean, you're living side by side. You're talking to each other. They know you, right? And they, because of that knowledge, they can give you this great feedback.
Good job.
Do men cut that feedback off oftentimes?
Yes.
We do. We don't want to hear it. You know, and worse than that, my most effective means of cutting that off was always to be sure to point out that there were equal flaws. Very effective, by the way.
I think.
Yeah. Part of what you learn over time. But you've got to be able to listen to that. And so kind of let's move ahead and think about, as an elder, what's the value of having a wife? That piece continues, doesn't it? You need that. And I've said a lot, you know, you get up in front and you make an announcement about something and no one's going to come and tell you that the tone that you used sounded just off.
Except for your wife.
Yeah, maybe the other elders. But except, you know, your wife should be able to. What if you've cut off that kind of feedback all along the way?
Continue making that same mistake.
Really a lot. And it's not just in a bigger, where it's really been particularly helpful with Kay has been in, you know, one-on-one with somebody, or wouldn't be one-on-one, she'd be there. But if we were talking to a couple or there was some woman that I was trying to counsel and she was there, she has a real sense for how effective that communication is. And you got to listen to those kinds of things. And how else is a wife, though, helpful as for an elder? An elder's wife helpful to him. How else do you think it's been?
Well, spend more time with your children probably than you do, so especially in the early young years. So to manage your household, she will help. I mean, great. Disciplining or raising your children.
That's part of the preparation side, and you got to do your part, but when we're talking about children and men, I think you'll see why that's so, so valuable.
I think the emphasis with compassion and empathy.
So, if that's not your natural trait, she's there to kind of help ease that for you a little bit.
She'll be communicating with different people in different ways, and will have a different feel for what's going on in the congregation.
Right. That's exactly right. By the way, one of the other reasons why I didn't want to stand up anymore, not only do you have the blessing, normally, he's not here today, of Marty being part of the class, and Larry's an elder, Ken's been an elder, Steve Green's been an elder. There's a lot of wisdom and experience in some of these roles we should be gaining from our class. She knows a part of the congregation. She understands the women better than you do. She has knowledge about things that are going on that you're going to need to hear. There are times when your counseling of a woman is much more effective if she's able to play some role in that. Or reinforce it. Or she may have the opportunity to speak to that person you don't, but will listen. There's so many good, valuable kinds of things.
When counseling a husband and a wife, it's good that an elder's wife is also present, and also the opportunity to enrich the whole hospitality aspect of
that. That's right. Yeah. Same. All of those are very valuable things. And I know y'all, you've probably heard it. I don't know how much you appreciate it, but when Marty stepped down as an elder, he really didn't do it out of a sense of, well, the scriptures, you know, the teaching about husband of one wife and all requires. I think he could probably make a pretty coherent scriptural argument that you could continue to serve from that standpoint as an elder. Two things that were kind of weighing on his mind. One was because there may be others who do feel clearly that passage may say that, you know, you shouldn't serve unless you have a living wife. Never be a disruption to your congregation. Now, he could have waited for weeks to have done that, but that's his choice. But the bigger part was just the effectiveness. He did not believe that he could serve effectively as an elder without marriage. And that part I think I could question a little more given his wisdom and stuff, but I can tell you as, you know, with the value of Kay to me, that I understand and I value his opinion, but that more than anything else drove it. All right, let's think about children for a minute. These passages here that I gave you, they talk about the responsibilities of fathers. And I don't think we would disagree that whatever is in these passages is probably a responsibility or caution for women too, but still it says fathers. There's a special responsibility or warning given to fathers. What is it? What's the special thing? Do not provoke your children. So there's some recognition of the fact that that's a possibility. And then you have in Hebrews 12, again, I would argue that mothers have the same responsibility, but it draws a comparison in trying to teach us about God's discipline. It brings back in whose discipline?
Fathers.
Yeah, the fathers, you know, who, in a flawed way, try to exercise the discipline for the good of their child. compared to God, who's always got our best interests at heart and knows the best and perfect way to do it, we struggle on at times. But that's still, there's this goal. And that Hebrews 12, by the way, what is the ultimate goal of discipline?
Righteousness.
Yeah, it says it in an interesting way, but it's really intended to be the righteousness of the individual.
It's holiness.
It's to share in God's holiness, you know. Which says to me, that's very similar kind of language. The cleansing, sanctifying, you know, making them holy. Just like you had that goal for your wife. That's the vision that fathers ought to have. And yet it kind of warns them, be careful, you know. Don't provoke them, you know. I'm interested on this latter part. I just get down to C. What skills or understanding is a man likely to gain from raising his children? It would be valuable to him if he were to serve as an elder. What do you get out of that as a father? You're getting it right now, those of you, especially the younger kind of children. Patience, right? And especially, I would say, in regard to this, that's my goal, is for them to be disciplined. It doesn't work overnight. I'm patient. Not just patience, like I got to put up with this noise, you know. It's patience. Let go. It takes a long time. What else?
I think lead by example. You're trying to model the behavior you want the children to have. And then, I guess, as an elder, you also look upon as a role model.
Makes a difference. Do they pay attention to the example?
Something that I've been thinking about recently, which is still doing good to them even though they're not doing the things that you want them to do.
Yeah.
That's been in my thought recently. Even though they fail you, do you say, you know what, as a result, hey, I'm not doing anything for you, or do you still continue to do good to them?
That's an interesting thing, because you're making sacrifices for your children. That should be part of the lesson too. You know, you can't really raise them correctly without living in an unselfish kind of way. And whether we've thought it through or not, generally, we don't just stop all good things for them when they're, you know, we do continue to make sacrifices for them. I don't know that they always see how much good we're doing, but we do. That's a good one. What else?
Arbitrator, settling dispute.
Yeah, between them. I should add it. I don't have that on this list. That's a really good one. That is a skill. You've never had to break up a brother and sister fighting.
So many different outside influences or things going on in their lives that continually change, that I think we have to understand that will cause them to react or do things differently sometimes.
So seeing something else that's bothering them outside of just kind of understanding the full influence on them to be able to get to the heart of how to help them. Well, elders have to do that all the time. You never get the same picture, but you need them.
Once, as you know your kids and their strengths and weaknesses, you tailor your raising and discipline around their strengths and weaknesses, and the same thing applies to meddling in the flock.
And are they the same? Are your two boys the same?
They're very different.
No, they're not.
But they look, I can never tell them apart. How could they be different? But they are, right? And recognizing that.
Not only that, but the stages of their lives as well.
Changing,
growing, what you mentioned too, is you learn to work with them, the different stages, and as you mentioned, the different individual kids are very helpful.
Yeah.
As well, to see, when you have the members, you'll find very similar circumstances and different life skills. Something you have to work with and deal with. That helps with that.
These are great. And not to dismiss it, if you have three boys, or like Marty, four boys and stuff, but man, if you get a girl as well. And those of you who have all daughters, man, I just... See? It is a different challenge. But again, it's like an extra opportunity. Understand the nature of a woman and how to help her. That's just very, very valuable. I want to kind of finish a little bit of this discussion but point out something, because I got this B question, and it's interesting to me that sometimes I kind of think about things that are on your mind at the time. I've begun to think more and more about this aspect of there is a test, I think, that is being presented in the qualifications to say, I'm looking at a man, I'm trying to decide, is he ready to serve as an elder? And so you got these testing grounds. So here's one. He's had this family situation that's been a great testing ground for him. What does it say about what he's done in it? I think, unfortunately, sometimes we look only at one thing about that, and that's the end product. And it's like, again, sort of like check, okay, oh, he's married. Oh, why? Oh, his children have been baptized. You know, check. You kind of get that. We also look at it in a different way, too. It's like, as long as the reputation of those children, where they are, and everything about them is just, it's absolutely what you would want it to be. You know, they're attending church, whatever. And especially if they've left home, it's like if everything's kind of absolutely perfectly in place, then that's proof that the man, if y'all can give me two extra minutes, it's sort of like proof that the man has been what he's supposed to be, and then we're satisfied and we're okay. I don't think that's as nuanced or as clear a picture of what this passage is really trying to say. If we go back to all this discussion about the vision of what you want is someone who's managed his house so well. He's done his work well. He's been the kind of father, the kind of husband that you want in him. I would actually say that if you look at men who've had some children who've kind of gone off for a while, and or been a real struggle, or you've had that son or that daughter that was just really hard to kind of figure out their person and how to get them kind of on the straight. And you know, they struggled in school. They had these other problems with friends or whatever. That's a training ground, right? That's a better training ground to be an elder than the one who just kind of had those kind of quiet, you know, children who just never really just kind of just plowed along and did everything easy. They were just kind of easy to handle. Because you're not going to get members who are all just kind of easy. There are a lot of members you don't have to do anything for. They just, they're, you know, just quietly serving the Lord, and that's the way it is. I would say pay attention also to those who have done everything you think a father ought to do. And at the end of it, yeah, there is some project to it at the end. It's not just a question of, well, they're not completely faithful, or there's still some question about them. Look at what the husband, the father did in those situations. And what you may have is that's a man who should be an elder. He's proven in every way that he managed his household well. Just a thought. A little richer picture in my mind about it maybe sometimes is that, okay, boy, never heard a peep from those two kids. He must have been a great father. Maybe. But he may not be so ready either because they were so easy, if you know what I mean. I will continue on in this lesson sheet. We have an extra class, by the way. There's going to be 14 classes because we did the ice storm thing, and I've gotten thinking through some ideas on that. If you got some ideas you can share, I'd love to hear them. But definitely another class on this material that may go into a little bit of a third class.